Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Hot Shot Wake Up. This is your weekly wildfire update. As fire season continues on through August, there's a lot of activity up in Northern California, but they are getting a handle, or I should say they're making progress on a lot of those fires which have been complexed in the last week. The Pacific Northwest, Oregon, and Washington saw a tremendous amount of lightning come through. Just individual forests were seeing 40, 45, 37 new starts, respectively, across the land that they manage. A lot of them being small, but they are bringing in a lot of resources. We'll cover all of those details. And we're also going to talk about a couple other things. There was this lessons learned that came out on the Elkhorn fire up in Idaho that I think is worthy of going over, that is talking about how they implemented their strategic plan to do point protection in this area and then continue on with suppression and containment activities after that and how they went about it. And if you're unaware, the Elkhorn fire, it didn't get a lot of attention, but it was a massive, massive fire up in Idaho that took place in this last month. The fire ran 9 miles, and what took place was structure protection, evacuating rafters, firefighters preparing to deploy, and it was just a crazy, crazy story that we now have the details on. And we're going to cover that lessons learned because I think it's something that we should be aware of, and for folks out there who are operational and logistically planning these types of fires in wildernesses and far-out areas, this is a good example of how to achieve a positive end when it comes to fire that's running across the landscape in an unexpected manner. There's a couple other things I'm going to touch on as well. Also, the pay update that's coming out of Congress, which I'm kind of going to rant on this initially and have this conversation about my thoughts on it. And, you know, I've been trying to take a real positive side on it because there is a lot of progress being made. But we've gotten to a point to where now I'm just super irritated about everything on it. And it's not just Congress, it's all sides. It's everything that's involved in it. It really started to piss me off, especially this morning. And, you know, it's a lot of angles. It's not just one side or the other, or, you know, the right or the left or the middle. It's all over the place. And, you know, I've been advocating for a very long time that stop attaching this to stuff, stop holding wildland firefighters compensation and benefits and all these other things. You know, stop holding it hostage for your advantage and re-election and getting other things passed, so on and so forth. And I respect all the people who are working in that positive way to promote change. But in the last week or so, you know, some folks have reached out. They're saying, hey, you should do this and you should do that. And I've expressed it before, like, God, don't tell me what to do. You know, I've been an advocate for this for 2 years. Yes, my platform has grown larger than I would have ever expected when it comes to an audience, especially on the social media side of things. And the podcast has really taken off. And again, thank you to the community who supports me, because I don't have any ads. I don't have any sponsorships. And it's 100% community supported through my Substack, which is thehotshotwakeup.substack.com. And where I'm going with this is it's just me. Like, I'm just one person who's doing all of the things that I do. And there's, you know, larger groups with 15 employees, 20 employees, 100 employees saying I should do more. And, you know, that's not my sole job here. And I'm trying to do a lot. Like, I really am. I've sacrificed quite a bit to maintain doing what I'm doing here. But there's a lot happening behind closed doors that folks don't see. And, you know, I've invited senators, representatives on the show who have asked me to promote this or promote that. And, you know, most of them say no. I've asked the chief of the Forest Service to come on, and the head of communications for that department confirmed a date for me to interview the chief of the Forest Service and then sent me an email and pulled out. and I haven't posted these emails, but I have the receipts for it all. And then they just go dark. And I contact them and I'm like, hey, and then, you know, folks reach out and they're like, hey, maybe you could promote this or talk about this. It's like, I've invited you on the show and you said yes and you didn't show up. I've done that with all of these groups out there. And I dozens of times I have invited folks on the show. They either say no or sign up and then don't show up to come on the show, which in my opinion, it's kind of disrespectful because I take time out of my day to do this. And again, I don't have any sponsorships. Like, I'm doing this on my free time. And then I have a whole day that I don't go to work to try to set up these interviews. And then they no show. If you can't tell, I'm a little frustrated about it all. Like, I just sat down with one of the largest media corporations on the planet, quite frankly, and I did a 30-minute sit-down recorded video interview with them, again, taking time out of my day to do these things. And what was it about? It was about wildfire. It was about promoting raises. It was about promoting legislation that helped wildland firefighters. And they canned the interview. 2 days later, they said their production team took a look at it and they said, well, we're not so sure we're going to have put something together with that. Which, okay, fine, your production team didn't like it. But this is why I've been hesitant to do these things, because it ends up being a waste of my time when I could just come on and talk about it and promote it the way I do. Now, on the Congress side of things, I'm not putting blame on any of these people, by the way, that I just talked about. I'm just expressing my frustration with them because I've offered them a giant platform to have these conversations. And they say no. And it's like, okay, but that's fine. But then don't contact me and tell me what to do. But I want to make it clear that I respect these people because they have a job in front of them. But hypocrisy gets to me and I just don't really like it. Congress, let's talk about that. It's just an utter mess. Like, they're already talking about a government shutdown. They're already talking about, hey, we're not going to pass this stuff by September 30th. And really what it comes down to is they have authorization to extend the pay raises through December, but they don't have the funding for it. And we're talking about $60 million. Again, $60 million is what we're currently arguing over in Congress. And again, it's just a temporary fix. It kicks the can down the road 2 months, really. 3 months is what it does. And now there's this fight over the government shutdown, and the whole thing is just a mess. And I have folks being like, you should call out the Republicans. And people on the other side are like, you should call out the Democrats. It's a bipartisan bill. So the problem is on both sides, because you already have both Republicans and Democrats signing on to this thing. So not only is it a bipartisan bill, it's also a bipartisan mess. Like, just get your stuff together and figure this out. They were holding hearings this last week, and both Democrats and Republicans were sitting in front of the panel saying, hey, we need the $60 million to make sure this goes till December. And then hopefully if the government doesn't shut down, we can figure out a permanent fix moving forward. When it comes to the grand scheme of things on what this costs for the United States budget, it's absolute peanuts. And it just goes to show that the people who are making policy legislation and have the power of the pen over the people's purse, that they really just don't give a shit. And I'm being frank here, because you have billions of dollars going all over the place, trillions of dollars being spent on stuff that isn't helpful for folks in the United States. And when it comes to just continuing to pay wildland firefighters what they are already getting paid, there's an argument of, oh my gosh, this just costs so much money. This just, oh geez, this is just, oh God, oh, oh. And it's embarrassing, and it's shameful is what it is. It's shameful. And yes, I know I'm a little bit fired up this morning, but I got to be honest with you. Like, I have a lot on my plate. I do as much as I can to advocate for these things. People who have been readers and listeners know that to be the case. It's just myself. I don't have any employees or anything like that. And maybe I'm just putting too much on myself as it is. You know, maybe I need to take a step back and, you know, just observe for a while. Because the last thing I want to do is get pulled into this quagmire, into this quicksand that everybody's playing in, when for 2 years I know how this sort of thing works. I've been saying it on the podcast and the Substack for a very long time, that this is just classic action when it comes to this stuff. You have senators and representatives, administration saying, oh my gosh, we have to do this thing. What a disaster. We care about our wildland firefighters. Then you have folks more in the nonprofit side and the advocacy side who are good people. They are. They're trying to do good, but it always just comes down to the wire. And I'm not saying it's anybody's fault. What I'm saying is I've seen it all before, and I'm not going to get dragged into this to take sides, so on and so forth. What I can do is I can offer these people a platform to come on and talk and advocate what they want. Talk about what they want and the reasons that they are doing it, and promote it to a massive audience that listens and reads to what I do. And they have decided not to do that. And that's from all sides. I'm talking the chief of the Forest Service, who committed to an interview and then backed out. The senators, representatives, folks on that side that I've reached out to, and other groups that I've reached out to and said, hey, you know, maybe we should take this beyond a direct message in an email sent privately and come on the show and talk about what it is. Because we all know it's coming down to the wire. That's so well known. And we're just kicking the can down the road and nothing permanent is happening. And ultimately, it's just, as you can probably hear, I'm frustrated with it all, because there's folks whose sole job it is to figure this stuff out. And then I get contacted and say, hey, you need to do more. You should do this. And out of respect, it's just like, hey, just like, I've offered so much to you folks. Don't tell me what to do. Like, just don't do that. And again, we're on the same team. It seems like we both want the same thing. But really, I've just become frustrated with the process that I see repeated over and over for well over a decade. And there is never a permanent fix. It's always just delaying it a little bit. Here's what I think is going to happen, and I could be wrong, but there's going to be a fight over a government shutdown. It's going to turn into a political fiasco. Maybe they will pass the $60 million to have the raises go out till December. That's ultimately what I think will happen. And then once December comes, there'll be another huge political fight and battle to say, hey, we need to fix this permanently. We need to have a permanent solution to all this. But then at that point, you're in an election year, which is going to drive the politicism of this topic even more, which is why I just wish they would figure it out before September 30th so this doesn't get dragged into an election year. Now, the other thing I want to talk about that some folks have told me, hey, don't express it this way because it makes it harder for us to get raises and it makes it harder for us to convince Congress that we need appropriations for these budgets. But I'm just going to spit facts, which is there's this thought. And I understand that, you know, people who look at my page and my social media, and I've addressed this, I've written many times on the Substack about this, that fire is a natural process on our planet. Yes, there are times that they're not natural wildfires, such as human-caused starts, arson, and others. But you shouldn't be scared of fire. You should be aware of fire and learn about it. Because the amount of just craziness surrounding this the last, you know, especially since the Maui fires, has been out of control. And folks saying, hey, it's Armageddon on planet Earth. And so let's just go over those numbers, which I think is important to look at. So far in 2023, we've had 38,123 fires for a total of 1.9 million acres. Now, for the 10-year average for the amount of fires that have started, we're right on track. It's 39,000. So we're having the same amount of fires. But when it comes to how many acres have burned, the average over 10 years is 5 million acres by this time, year to date. So we are at about 34% average, 36% average acres burned. So this is an extremely slow year. It's the slowest fire year in over a decade. But the caveat is this: arsons are up, and up a lot. And I don't know why that is. I don't know exactly what's behind that. If you're a longtime listener or reader, you know that I cover this quite a bit, and I know quite a bit about this subject. So when folks on the internet, other places, people with a platform come out and say, hey, this is Armageddon, it's the worst ever, it's not. Like, this could go down as one of the slowest fire seasons in the United States in a very, very long time. It could also go down as one of the most human-caused starts and even arson in a very, very long time. Over in Greece, they made a big splash in the European press about how this Greece fire, the fire in Greece, was the largest fire burning in Europe, so on and so forth. Look how bad it is. We need new taxes and legislation. And that's what really gets me, is when they come out and say, hey, we need to create new policy around this because of how bad it is. Then, I've been reporting it since April, they arrested 79 people for arson. And not just, hey, this was a negligent fire, you were burning a trash pile, or you were, you know, running machinery on a dry day and it sparked and it caused a fire. Those numbers were reported as well, because there was a total of like 141 arrests for causing fires. And then 79 of those were arsonists. And they came out and they said, hey, we have a problem over here. There's a lot of people starting fires. That being said, even Europe is below average for acres burned this year. In Spain, I've talked about it at length, they came out, their ministers came out and said, we have fire terrorists running around starting fires. In the Pacific Northwest, the Forest Service put out a report saying that there was nearly 150% increase in annual human-caused fires. Now, all of those aren't arson. That was a more of a broad stroke saying that, hey, whether it's negligent or arson, they have increased 150% in the Pacific Northwest. They put out a statement saying that the summer average for human-caused starts and undetermined fires is sitting at 87, usually this time of year. And since June 1st of this summer, they've seen 197, which is a massive uptick. And they have below-average acres burned. And the whole point being that fire seasons are cyclical. There's a cycle involved. And I think people need to look at the numbers and say, what is this fire season like? And then what is this fire season like on a 10-year average? If you look at last year, it was very, very busy. And it was higher than the 10-year average. And folks who want to make the argument, which I see all the time, people email me all the time, message me and say, well, the fires are actually worse even though it's arson. So it doesn't matter that there's arson because the fires are worse anyway. And that's just not true, especially this year. It's just not true. And I'm not going to get into the whole climate change debate because I've had that before on the podcast. I'm not a climatologist. I'm not a scientist. I know operations and logistics in the wildfire world very well. And I know arson very well. And I know how wildfires work. I know how you put them out. I also know how you start them. And I think it's disingenuous to just toss out this year's numbers, which a lot of people are doing. And they're just like, well, you know, this year's, you know, we can't just take this year. You know, we had some rain and blah, 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 blah. It's like, but you can't discard it. Like, if you, like, that's, you can't do that. And then you have folks on the other side who are saying that there are direct energy weapons and all of the arsonists are being paid by globalists who are running around starting these things to push the agenda. And, you know, I don't know. Like, there's a case down in South America that I've proven to be true where that was taking place. But there's no evidence showing that that's the case. If you can show me that this is happening on a grand scale, okay, I'll report on it. But what you have is copycats and people who run out and start fires. And there's crazy people on this planet who just run out and start these things. But as I wrote on the Substack, it's not all about how these fires started. And it's important to know how these fires started because we can take numbers and put things on graphs and take data and understand the trends that are happening, but it's the response. And you need to focus on the response and see how it's being molded and put out in the public and say, okay, there was this lightning caused fire. How are they talking about that? These arson fires, how are they talking about that? And on the grand scheme of things, whether it's the pay issues or talking about how bad wildfire season is, there's just a lot of people who are being disingenuous on how they are talking about it. And as I said at the top of the show, like, I don't want to get dragged down in the quicksand and the quagmire of the itty bitty and nitpicking all of this. Like, I know over the last couple of years, wildfires have and were more severe and larger. That's true. This year is looking to be at least a 10-year record slow year. It could be a 20, 30-year record slow year, just depending on how it all plays out into the end. The big thing is wildfire needs to be detached from the political sphere because that's when all of these things come about and you run into all sorts of problems where you just get dragged into the bureaucracy. And I know there's a ton of good people, and I respect their work, that just slowly get dragged into the DC political system and the bureaucracy, and either they get disenfranchised or they get pulled into the system, however it works. I don't know. I'm doing my best to stay out of it. But wildfire is fairly straightforward when it comes to how did these things start, how is it being managed, what's the narrative around these fires and containment and so on and so forth. And someone brought up a pretty interesting point to me the other day where they want a breakdown of the numbers when it comes to how much is naturally burned fire in the acres and how much is we're building boxes around these things, which that's typical operations. You should do that. That's how you put out a fire. But if you take a 1,200-acre fire and build a 10,000-acre box around it and burn it, maybe we could separate those numbers and see how many acres like lit and burned and how many acres were naturally burned by lightning, or if it was a human-caused fire, how much acres is that compared to what you're ripping off? That may be a difficult thing to produce and start keeping track of, but again, I think those would just be interesting numbers to see. Now, on that note, we should talk about what the fires are doing around the United States and in other places. There was a tremendous amount of lightning that came through the Pacific Northwest. A lot of small fires started, and folks did a good job keeping them small. There's a couple that got bigger. This Camp Creek fire near the Bull Run Reservoir, which is Portland's main source of drinking water, that thing started to chunk away. They brought in an incident command team to manage that out of the Great Basin. 900 acres last reported. And a couple other fires that have started as well, plus fires that have been going for a very long time. In the United States, nationally, you have a preparedness level 4. There were 49 fires in the last 24 hours. 3 new large incidents. And there are 59 uncontained large fires. There are 23 teams currently committed to those fires. That's a lot. That's a lot of teams out there. And 46 fires being managed for something other than full suppression, which is that resource benefit action that's being taken on these things, which is down. That was higher the last time we talked about this. Starting up in that Pacific Northwest area, they're at a preparedness level 5, which is the highest. They brought in all sorts of resources and a lot of very expensive fires. The Lookout fire is still burning. It grew by 2,600 acres in the last 24 hours. That's pushing 20,000 acres up on the Willamette National Forest. That is a Type 1 fire. And that same team is also managing the Bedrock fire, which is 32,000 acres. They have a combined 1,700 personnel on those fires and a total of $78 million in cost. Now, let's think about this just for a second. Those two fires have cost $78 million, and Congress is fighting over $60 million to extend pay through December. Just going to throw that in there. Two fires in Oregon have cost more than what a bipartisan bill is asking to keep pay where it's at for wildland firefighters, and they're arguing about it. I think that's an important note to throw in there. Also in the Pacific Northwest, Washington, you have the Oregon Road Fire at 11,000 acres. The Gray Fire, which burned up a lot of homes, it says that 326 structures were lost. On the Oregon Fire, they're saying 384 structures were lost, both up in Washington. And then a number of smaller fires that are continuing to burn, and a lot of them are being wrapped up. Some of these fires' containment are pushed back to October 1st, which basically is till the snow flies. And there's other fires in Washington that they have containment estimates pushed back into November. Northern California, a lot of activity the last week. A lot of these fires got complexed. You have the Smith River complex, which is 7 fires. Happy Camp complex, which is 6 fires. And the SRF Lightning Complex up on Six Rivers National Forest with 7 fires in that. 2 Type 1 complexes, 1 Type 2 complex. Very expensive fires. The Smith River Complex, 66,000 acres. They have 2,500 people on those fires for a cost of $17.8 million. The Happy Camp Complex, 18,000 acres. They have 3,311 people on that complex for a cost of $33 million. And this Lightning Complex, 9,000 acres. They have 500-ish people on that fire for a cost of $15.2 million. Again, the combined cost of those three complexes cost as much as what they're asking for in Congress to continue pay for wildland firefighters. Do you understand the insignificant amount of money that they're fighting over? It's shameful and pathetic that they haven't figured this out. While you have people sleeping in the dirt, away from their families, wondering what the next paycheck's going to look like. While there's people on social media and the internet and TV and these news shows saying how horrific the wildfire season is and how we need to change policy and legislation to make sure this doesn't ever happen again. And it turns out that it's a record slow fire season, and we're arguing over $60 million if we should pay our wildland firefighters. This is the state of where we're at. It's pathetic. Okay, sorry about that. We'll move on to the southern area. Texas has been busy. Louisiana, tons of fires. That Tiger Island fire ripped. The Shearwood Creek fire ripped. They keep costs down, though. Tiger Island, 31,000 acres, only $3 million. The Ida fire in Louisiana, $1.7 million at 2,200 acres. They have a minor cold front coming through. And when I say that, it's like they've had 105 degrees and the cold front is going to bring it down to 91 degrees. Humidity will come up, though. And the hope is that that helps with containing these current active fires. The Northern Rockies area, no new fires, and they're cleaning up the fires that they have. This River Road East fire ate up 58 structures. This was outside Paradise, Montana, 17,000 acres, 700 people, $6.6 million. The East Fork fire up on the Kootenai, 5,100 acres, $13.4 million. Ridge Creek on the Idaho Panhandle, 4,400 acres. They got 512 people on it at a cost of $17.2 million. And all of these fires that I've talked about up in Montana and Idaho, containment is growing every single day, and progress just keeps happening. With the weather that came through, it's really giving firefighters and fire managers an advantage to start wrapping these things up. There's also fires in those areas like the Consolas, the Midnight, and others that have been burning for over a month, and they're still not fully contained, 89%, 92%. And it'll be interesting to see in the next couple weeks if it dries out and warms back up to where the Northern Rockies area, we'll see some new fires come through with lightning and storm systems and all these other things. The Great Basin went down to a PL2. Again, they've seen some cooler, wetter weather. The East Fire is the most prominent one up there. However, they do have 18% containment on it, 3,300 acres, $7.5 million, 452 people currently on that. And that's on the Boise National Forest up in Idaho. The Thompson Ridge Fire, which started quite a bit ago, 85% contained, $6.5 million, and they're making great progress. The Elkhorn on the Payette, 26,000 acres, 88% contained, and that's what we're going to talk about in this next segment, is how they were able to wrap that up so quickly. The Rocky Mountain area, which is at a PL2, they've slowed down as well, a couple small fires, but not a whole lot going on there. The Southwest area, the only fire really of note down there that has action on it and things taking place is this Valentine Fire on the Tonto National Forest. It's 14 acres. They have 250 people on it. 250 people on 14 acres. And what they're doing is they are building a box, and they're probably just going to manage this thing. They brought in a Type 2 team, Southwest Team 4, and they're starting to prep a box. I don't know if they're going to rip this thing off or what their plans are. We'll have to see what the weather brings, because if it starts really getting cold and raining down there, they just might even have a hard time burning it off. But other than that, not a lot happening in the Southwest area. Alaska has slowed down. They're due a PL1. Things are getting wrapped up there. And Southern California really is not seeing any action at all. California has been extremely slow compared to the historic averages. That's the operational update. Up in Canada, British Columbia continues to burn, but they have favorable weather for a little bit that has helped out. The last podcast on Substack was all about those fires and the issues that they were having with the tension between firefighters, the community, and policymakers that led to all sorts of really horrible things happening and confrontations that really didn't need to happen. If you want to hear that, it's the last podcast on Substack. You can check that out. And on that note, thank you to all the paid Substack subscribers. I'm 100% supported through that, 100% community supported. No ads, no sponsorships, and I wouldn't be able to do everything that I do without that. If you want to participate in that, just go to the hotshotwakeup.substack.com and click on that subscribe button, and that will support everything that I do.
I have traveled this year over all the United States, through the Alleghenies, the White Mountains, and the Catskills, the Rockies and the Bitterroot Mountains, the Cascades, the Coast Range, and the Sierras.
So back on July 24th, the Elkhorn Fire started on the Payette National Forest in the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness. And this is a very remote area. There's some folks who have some cabins back there. There's some lodges as well. And it could have turned into a 100,000, 200,000 acre fire, one of these massive fires. But a lot of good work was put in, and the planning and logistics and operational prowess of the individuals who were in charge made sure that didn't happen. And they put out a lessons learned on this, which is kind of rare to throw something out this quick for a fire. And I think it's a good one to go over because it shows the actions that they took and how successful they were in stopping this thing and ultimately freeing up resources to go other places. So I'd like to go through this and give the audience an idea of how planning and operations for a large-scale incident like this takes place, how it unravels, and what the timelines are like. So it starts with the background of this fire. It says the Elkhorn fire was detected on the evening of July 24th of this year and was quickly responded to by McCall Smoke Jumpers and the Payette National Forest Snowslide Wildland Fire Module based out of McCall. Shout out McCall Smoke Jumpers. Shout out Snowslide Wildland Fire Module. The fire grew from the initial light smoke seen by the Sheep Eater Lookout and estimated at 100 acres by the time the smoke jumpers arrived on scene. Shout out Sheep Eater Lookout. Nice catch on that one. By the next evening, the fire had already grown to 1,250 acres. Due largely to the fire's remote location, the challenging logistics, and the potential for continued growth, a local Type 3 incident management team was assembled to assume command of the incident on July 26th. The U.S. Congress has designated the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness in 1980. It now encompasses a total of 2.3 million acres. Administration of the wilderness is accomplished by two U.S. Forest Service regions, the Northern and Inner Mountain, and four national forests are involved, including the Salmon Chalice, the Payette, the Nez Perce, and Bitterroot, so multiple states, Idaho and Montana. As with most other wilderness areas within the national forest system, land management plans to allow for fire to play its natural role within the ecosystem. Cool. Absolutely, as it should be. While contain and control strategies are still utilized and appropriate, a strategy of monitor and point protection of values at risk allows the fire to assume its natural role while maximizing any incident's first objective, which is to provide firefighter and public safety. Now, contain and control, point protection, and monitor is a strategy you see very often up in Alaska, and it's what you're seeing up in Canada as well. You're not throwing everything you have at these fires. You're protecting the values at risk, and then you are allowing it to burn while you continually reassess what the hazards are and what the priority protection points are as this thing burns itself out. After 5 days of moderately active growth, the fire was estimated at 2,000 acres. On the afternoon of July 30th, the Elkhorn fire made a 20,000-acre, 9-mile run up into the Salmon River Canyon. It destroyed 7 structures and required firefighters to make quick decisions and take independent action to ensure that not only their own safety would be adhered to, but the public as well. Now, on the day of this giant run, this is what took place. It says, on the morning of July 30th, the Type 3 Incident Command Team and trainee were at the Incident Command Post at Campbell's Ferry near the heel of the fire on the Payette National Forest. They had been observing the fire's behavior for 5 days. It was still burning up drainage and to the south side of the Salmon River in its run up the slope, flank across, rollout, rinse, repeat type pattern. So what that means for folks who don't understand that terminology is the fire was burning on the south side of the river. It would, quote, run up that slope, flank across that slope. You would get rollout, which is you have burning embers, logs that are on fire. You know, you can have a tree fall down that's burning and then a log break off of that or a piece of it break off, and it can roll downhill hundreds of yards and start fires the whole way. We call that rollout. And then rinse, repeat means that this was just happening over and over and over again. The forecasted weather was hot and dry with some breeze, not atypical to July weather in this canyon. Temperatures were in the high 90s and humidities were 10 to 15%. Winds were southwest 5 to 10. Assigned to the Elkhorn fire, a total of 14 McCall smoke jumpers, the Snowslide Type 1 Wildland Fire Module, and a 10-person module Crew 11 from the Boise National Forest. They had been working for 5 days to this point to implement structure protection and at privately owned Whitewater Ranch, located directly on the Salmon River. Also, the Yellow Pine Ranch, located 3 river miles from the fire's edge. So really not that far, especially if the fire's going to make a 9-mile run. They had a primary plan in place, which was if the fire should jump the canyon, utilize air support to attack any spot fires that cross the canyon. If unsuccessful, their structure protection measures would be utilized to herd the fire around the privately owned ranches, which you do that through burning operations. You burn around these properties as the fire approaches, creating a buffer. Using contracted jet boats to move personnel between the river ranches and helicopters to sling in all the equipment. A typical day included testing the pumps, improve the plans for point protection, hiking the canyon to monitor the fire's behavior, and waving at rafters enjoying their floats along the longest undammed river in the United States. Between the daily tasks, there was regular conversations with private landowners still going about their daily lives at the ranches. Most of the folks who lived there had been there for a very long time. They are no stranger to wildfire and can provide a wealth of knowledge regarding fire behavior, fire history, local weather, and logistics of living remotely in the Salmon River Canyon. As I talk about all the time, local knowledge and locals in the area can provide you so much information and can be actionable when it comes to putting plans into place. These people are usually very, very prepared for this sort of thing. As it says in this report, by the end of the day on July 30th, landowners, firefighters, and rafters would all become part of the same crew to ensure everybody's safety. By 1400 on July 30th, the incident commander noticed the winds beginning to pick up with a few lenticular clouds overhead. Nothing crazy as far as velocity when it came to the winds, but it was a few hours earlier than it had been in the last few days. The fire was progressing up canyon and was approaching an old burn scar consisting of heavy brush, dead and down timber on this northeast aspect of the terrain. At 1530, which if you don't know military time, that's 3:30 in the afternoon, a spot fire across the river near Yellow Pine Ranch was observed by Crew 11 and Snowslide Wildfire Module. As planned, the crews ordered a Type 1 helicopter, fired up all the pumps. By 1600 or 4 o'clock p.m., continued fallout from the column was creating more and more spot fires, some within the perimeter of the hose lay. The spot fires grew rapidly under now high winds reaching 60 miles an hour and beyond the limits of which helicopters could operate. So they ran into kind of a nightmare scenario late in the afternoon. At that point, they started losing all their helicopters, and with all those spot fires, you are kind of shit out of luck at that point in time trying to get anything to hold. It continues saying, fully aware of the increasing complexity, Violet, one of the Snowslide crew members, an FFT1, with 5 years of experience, is assigned to head upstream 4 miles in a jet boat, captained by the owner of the Allison Ranch, to stop rafters at Bargaman Bar, preventing them from floating into the firestorm that is quickly unfolding downriver. Great plan to have in place. You rip up river and say, hey, don't go any further. With ample time available in the previous days to prep the Yellow Pine Ranch, firefighting efforts were largely successful in protecting the ranch with no structures lost. However, the fire was now off to the races and heading toward another private value at risk 2.5 river miles upstream. Under more predictable conditions, would have taken the fire days to get there. When the 4 smoke jumpers arrived at this Allison Ranch by jet boat on July 30th, their mission was straightforward: continue to triage the ranch and begin setup and protection equipment that had been dropped off the day before. Allison Ranch is substantial in size, including 12 structures spread out on a slope. Therefore, the setup was anticipated to take a couple days. The fire that morning was still 7 miles away from this area. There seemed to be plenty of prep time available. Around 1530, radio traffic began to increase from the situation that was unfolding at the Yellow Pine Ranch. However, during this time, the jumpers recalled very little wind at their location, and the smoke column was still barely visible downriver. By 1630, 1 hour later, it was completely different at their location. Within an instant, the smoke and 60-mile-an-hour winds that the Yellow Pine Ranch had experienced were now bearing down not only on the smoke jumpers, but also the residents. 6-inch firebrands were falling all around them, and thick clouds of smoke with the high winds, the jumpers considered burning out as best they could around the ranch. But with well-established spot fires seemingly everywhere, their focus quickly shifted to immediate safety of themselves and the residents at the ranch. At that point, 90-mile-an-hour gusts of wind broke tops of trees off. The jumpers and the residents made their way down to the safety of the sandbar on the riverbank next to the ranch. So just an incredible weather event came through. Now we head back upstream trying to stop the rafters. It says, when Violet arrived upstream at Bargaman Bar, the smoke and the wind had already gotten there. The plan was for her to remain at Bargamon to stop raft traffic at the relative safety of the nearby sandbar while the jet boat driver ran back downriver to check on his family ranch and property. Before he departed, Violet remarks, "Don't forget about me." Yeah, absolutely. Please remember that I'm here. Now alone with her line gear and radio, the spot fires becoming established on both sides of the river, Violet took a minute to roll up a smoke and gathered some situational awareness. Great move, Violet, I must say. I probably would have done the same thing. Roll up a filterless cigarette, take a couple puffs, clear your mind and think, what the hell is going to be my next move? Over the radio, she could hear the jumpers back at Allison Ranch attempting to burn out and eventually declare we're headed to the safety zone. She thought to herself, this thing is coming right at me, and this definitely isn't a legit safety zone. What if I have to deploy my shelter? So it's getting to this point on this Elkhorn fire where people have that little voice in the back of their head saying, I might need to deploy my shelter. I might need to really take action to save my life at this point. After she collected her thoughts, she began scraping out the deployment area in the sand with her rhino tool, limbing up nearby brush with her handheld silky saw and prepping for what she knew had to be done if she was to ride this thing out. With fusees in her line gear, she radioed back to ICP and notified them of her intention to burn out her location. ICP quickly responded with, if that's what you need to do, we support the plan. By this time, AirAttac was overhead providing updates on the fire's progression to ICP and reaching out to Violet on air to ground asking if she was okay. Violet replied that she was, but recalls when AirAttac asks if you're okay, that's not good. And yeah, if AirAttac is asking if you're in a good spot, there's multiple times where AirAttac or a helicopter has reached out to me when I'm off in the green somewhere checking things out. And they're like, yo, are you sure you're okay in there? And that's when you think to yourself, ah, okay, maybe I am not in the greatest spot. Just as she was about to start burning out, through the smoke and the wind came a large group of boaters. 4 loaded rafts, 4 inflatable kayaks, and 12 people, including kids, all headed straight downstream towards the fire. Upon hearing that the group of rafters showed up at Bargamon Bar, right when Violet was planning to burn out, Dale, one of the smoke jumpers at Allison Ranch, decided to head upriver to assess Violet at her location. With the jet boat operator's family now safe and accounted for, the smoke jumper and the boat operator, who was fully aware that he had just lost his house, headed back upriver. Meanwhile, the remaining jumpers hiked back to Allison Ranch to see if they could save anything after the fire's initial pulse. As the rafters at Bargamon Bar eddied out to the sandbar to tie in with Violet, she could see the concerned and exhausted looks on their faces and tears running down the cheeks from the smoke that they were eating. The rafters informed her that their intention had been to camp for the night. However, it had become clear that that was no longer a good idea. When the jet boat arrived shortly afterwards, Violet, Dale, and the boat operator started to develop a plan. Now, just imagine this. There is all hell breaking loose around you. You're in the middle of the wilderness. AirAttac's like, yo, are you okay? You good where you're at? And then you have multiple families of rafters pulling up to your location being like, what's going on? What? Oh my gosh, help me. What a mess. Like, you got a mess on your hands. Their plan quickly came together, it says. They deflated the kayaks and leave them on the sandbar. They used the jet boat to take the kids to the sandbar at Allison Ranch and ultimately Whitewater Ranch and have the remaining adults row the rafts and gear to the Allison Ranch along with Violet and Dave. Violet and Dave grabbed life jackets from the jet boat, helped the kids aboard, and sent them downriver. Still in their boots and Nomex, they hopped in the rafts and started downriver themselves. Back at the ranch, 3 jumpers made their way to the slope to the structures to see what they could salvage. As propane tanks vented from the intense heat and rounds of ammunition discharged from the inside of the burning buildings, they knew it was not a safe place to remain and made their way back to the sandbar to assist their next mission, which ultimately is evacuation. From Violet's seat in the raft, she could see the oarsman's exhaustion. He had been on the river all day, rowing into a headwind that only seemed to get worse. Having some whitewater experience herself and knowing what rapids were ahead to get to Allison Ranch, she offered to take the oars a bit. The oarsmen gratefully accepted, and they continued toward the waiting jet boat at the ranch. Once the rafts arrived there, an additional jet boat from downriver joined the mix. The plan was to shuttle all the rafters down to Whitewater Ranch. However, due to the Class 3 and 4 rapids between Allison and Whitewater Ranches, it became apparent that the rafts would need to remain at Allison Ranch overnight. In a race against the darkness, the jet boats and their experienced operators took a load after load of people and gear through the shallow rapids, wind, and smoke to clear air and safety down at Whitewater Ranch. As the sun went down over what they're calling one hell of an afternoon in the Salmon River breaks, all but three jumpers at Allison Ranch who remained at the sandbar overnight recovered to either Whitewater Ranch or to ICP at Campbell's Ferry. Exhausted and hungry, but physically unharmed, everyone involved in the Elkhorn fire blow-up ended the day with a fresh perspective of the power and unpredictability of wildfire in the Salmon River Canyon. Unbelievable day. Wild set of events. You go from getting in a boat and your mission being, hey, just tell the rafters they got to chill, they can't come down here, to I think I need to deploy my fire shelter. Then on to a full-blown rescue mission of children and families, all while there's a 9-mile wildfire run taking place in a wilderness. That's a big, big day, and you're going to be rattled. And, you know, Violet probably smoked more than one filterless cigarette that day. That's my guess. Same with the jumpers. They provide some lessons that can be learned from this, saying when operational tempo changes, so does our brain function. Absolutely. I talk about that often on the Substack. Taking a short moment, just as Violet did at the sandbar, to consider personal safety is a valuable tool in navigating the fog of war and subsequently leads to crew safety and accountability in stressful situations. 100%. Next, it says, be human when interacting with the public. Show leadership and empathy and listen to them. Again, that was the last podcast on Substack. That's what I talked about. Many times, the most stressful situations we find ourselves as firefighters around the public. Take a moment to consider their position, evacuations, the loss of their possessions, fear, panic, and in some cases, the loss of loved ones. Empower your people to make decisions and build trust on a foundation of good information. 100%. We're adults in this industry, and oftentimes you need to break off for secondary and tertiary missions, and we need to be able to rely on you to make decisions for yourself. We want to empower you and train you to be able to do those sorts of things. It says, make no mistake, point protection is working out in front of the fire. If we didn't think that the fire had a chance at reaching a value, we likely wouldn't spend the time or effort protecting it. And a lot of the times on these wildfires, both, you know, early rookie firefighters and even the public, you see crews prepping 5 miles out from the fire. And you start to think to yourself after day three, like, why are we prepping around these structures? The fire's never going to get here. Well, you'll get a 60-mile-an-hour wind day, and it'll be there in a few hours is all it takes. That's why it's good to have these critical plans and logistics and planning in place to where you can get this stuff set up and have these operations where you've set yourself up for success down the line. And lastly, it's something I say at the end of every podcast. They say mental mop-up. Facilitating healing and learning after an event. After a critical event, people need to connect with others who were involved in the incident. This allows people to share their stories, validate their experiences, and move forward with a network of support. Yes, and it's good to facilitate that. It's why I tell people to reach out to their homies, talk to people they haven't seen in a while, and catch up with other firefighters, because it helps with all of that stuff when you move forward with these healing processes and just the stress and the post-traumatic stress that comes with all of this stuff. The Elkhorn fire wasn't widely talked about. I covered it extensively. I was talking to people up there on the Payette saying, hey, man, this thing's cranking. There's a lot of stuff going on up here. And now after this report came out, it's a lot more clear on what actually took place and what happened. Congratulations, straight up. You know, props to everybody who was involved. It sounds like you planned out, you made the right choices. You were free-thinking adults and able to problem solve which is the greatest, you know, arguably the greatest trait of a highly successful wildland firefighter, is someone who can think on their feet, take action, make multiple plans because things change so quickly. And when you're thrown with a curveball, you're able to adjust, adapt, overcome, and still be successful. Crazy story. And, you know, it's not one you haven't heard before, but this year, it's one of the more harrowing stories coming out during this fire season. That's the show for today. Thanks for tuning in. I appreciate everybody who supports the show, all of the updates that I do, helps with the donations that I provide when those come about. The most recent one, there was a Jackson hotshot who lost his father, and a bunch of unexpected expenses came up. So we were promoting that on the social media. But thanks to everybody who is a paid Substack subscriber. If you want to participate in that, just go to thehotshotwakeup.substack.com. Click on that subscribe button. There should be a link below as well. And on that note, reach out to someone you haven't talked to in a while. Hit up your homies, see how they're doing. Get outside, get some exercise, some fresh air, stretch, hydrate, eat those quality calories. Get the rest you need because you need that to recover. But as always, when you get up, you got to get it done. Oh.